Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Matthew with The Outrages of Herod. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. We are studying the Gospel of Matthew, and I believe the purpose of this Gospel is to present Jesus as the Christ, the King of Israel. It is another grand treatise like the book of John was, and its purpose is to prove to Israel who Jesus really is. It's the book of being in Israel, in contrast to Ephesians, the book of believers today who are in Christ. Now today we're starting out in Matthew chapter 14 and considering the final fate of John the Baptizer, or as I've suggested this word baptism means, John the Identifier, and considering the outrageous actions of the usurper King Herod. So Matthew 14 in verse 1. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the report about Jesus. Now what's a tetrarch? Well, tetra meaning four, a tetrarch was the arch, the top leader or first one of a fourth of a region. Now, while that's technically what it meant, it could sometimes be used less technically for a fraction of a region, even if it wasn't exactly a fourth. But that's what a tetrarch was. Now, he was ruling over a fourth or so of the former realm of Herod the Great, that one who had been ruling at the time of Christ's birth and tried to put him to death with the wise men. Now his realm had been divided among his sons, one of them being this Herod. Now this Herod was apparently the one known to history as Herod Antipas, and he was the son of Herod the Great by Malthasi. So he heard the report the people were giving about Jesus, verse 2, and said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He is risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him." So when he heard about Jesus, he said this to his servants. But this isn't the Greek word doulos, which is the proper word for slaves, but it's actually the word for children. He said to his children. But we doubt it literally means his children. Often this word is used to mean his servants or attendants. We might say his young retainers. So he said to his young retainers. Now he reasons about John. He reasons that the Lord is John come back from the dead. And no doubt this was his own guilt prompting him to think this. But he reasons that because he's come back from the dead, risen from the dead, these powers are at work in him. And powers here is the Greek dunamis, from which we get our word dynamite. And the Greek word means inherent power. So he says these inherently powerful works are because he's risen from the dead. Verse 3. For Herod had laid hold of John and bound him, and put him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife. So we read that Herod had laid hold of or seized John. We might say he had arrested him when he seized him and bound him. And then he put him in prison. So he had actually imprisoned him, and he had been there for some time. And he did this, we read, for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife. Now, this Herodias was actually a granddaughter of Herod the Great. And this is kind of interesting that not only was he going to name his sons Herod after himself, but it seems he was so anxious to get his name in there that he even named his daughter Herodias to get his own name in there. It'd be kind of like if I tried to name my daughter Nathanette or Nathania or something, just so I could get my name into hers because I was so proud of my name. So he had named his daughters after himself, and he named his daughter Herodias, or in this case, his granddaughter. Probably her own father had gotten the name in there. Now, this Herodias, the granddaughter of Herod the Great, had married her half-uncle, Herod Philip I. But apparently she had not been overly pleased by him, and afterwards had an unlawful union with her husband's brother, Herod Antipas. And that is how she was with him at this point, although I'm not sure if they were officially married. Now, history tells us that she was ambitious on her husband's behalf, and perhaps on her own too, probably. And she had persuaded Herod Antipas to go to Rome to seek the title of king, like his father had had, rather than just tetrarch. However, Agrippa, another son of Herod, had dispatched a freedman of his, a freed slave, to Rome to bring charges against Herod Antipas for some of his corrupt actions. And Rome found him guilty, and after which he was exiled rather than made royalty. Now, one good thing we can say about Herodias, though, is apparently, though she hadn't loved her husband, Herod Philip I, she apparently was loyal to Herod Antipas because she had followed him into exile, even though she wasn't exiled and needn't have done so. So at least we can say that in her favor. But it was because of this Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, that he had thrown John in prison. Well, why was that? Verse 4. Because John had said to him, "It is not lawful for you to have her." So John had spoken on the legality of this arrangement. And this is probably referring back to Leviticus 18, which contains the laws of incest. In verse 6, "None of you shall approach unto anyone who is near of kin to him to uncover his nakedness. I am the Lord." And of course, uncovering the nakedness is a biblical euphemism for sexual intercourse. And so this is not to happen with one who is near of kin to you. And the specific case we're talking about here of incest is in verse 16 of Leviticus 18. "You shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife. It is your brother's nakedness." So Leviticus 18:16 there says that it's not lawful to marry your brother's wife. And of course, this would include even if he had divorced her, it still was not lawful. However, note that though divorce didn't make any difference, death did. And this law only applied while the brother was still alive. How can I say this for sure? Well, when the brother had died, the law actually expected a brother to marry his wife in certain circumstances. We can read about that in Deuteronomy chapter 25 and verse 5, which says, "If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her." So, clearly, death ended this particular incestuous relationship. It wasn't incestuous anymore. But divorce or anything else did not. It was unlawful to marry your brother's wife as long as your brother was alive. Now I wonder, how had this come up? How had it come about that John had told Herod this? And it makes me wonder, had Herod actually asked John about the legality of his union with Herodias, his brother's wife? Or did John just offer this on his own? Well, if Herod had asked, he probably expected what kings usually get, that is, a yes-man answer that tells them exactly what they want to hear. And good old King Henry VIII, when he wanted to divorce his wife Catherine, and his claim was it was because she had formerly been married to his brother, who was now dead, and he wanted to know if that was legal or not, plenty of people, including, sadly, plenty of the Protestant leaders, said, oh yes, King Henry VIII, absolutely, it's illegal for you to have married her. It's absolutely right for you to divorce her and marry somebody else. Absolutely right. Well, I don't think that was right because his brother was dead. So it'd been perfectly fine for him to be married to her. But of course, these Protestant leaders were influenced by the fact that they wanted Henry VIII to favor the Protestant Reformation. So Herod probably expected John to be a yes man and say it was perfectly legal. But of course, He didn't figure with dealing with a real prophet. See, when you go to a real prophet, you get God's real answer. You don't get what kings expect, the answer they want to hear. Now, Luke 3:19 tells us that John had also chided him for all the evils which Herod had done. So besides this just having his brother's wife, he told him all the other things he'd done that was wrong. And so Herod, furious, because of course you don't do that to a king, had him thrown in prison. Now some people, in rating what John did here, instead of saying what I have said, that John was a faithful prophet and had to repeat the truth, have blamed him for being too harsh, or being too critical, or being too judgmental. And here he had a chance to witness to Herod, and instead he earns his wrath by his strict Old Testament viewpoint. Well, so much for them viewing John as a prophet like the Lord did. But the fact is that if you want a yes man, if you want somebody who's going to take it easy on you and take it easy on your sin, you can probably go to some modern day pastors and they won't condemn you for your wicked actions. But if you go to a real prophet, he's going to tell you the truth. And so those who say this kind of thing about John the Baptist, well, they're kind of showing how much truth you can expect from them when it comes to the Bible's teaching of right and wrong. Verse 5. And although he wanted to put him to death, he feared the multitude, because they counted him as a prophet. So he wanted him put to death. That's actually the word he willed. The Greek is thelo, meaning the will in the sense of the wish or the desire. He desired, wished to put him to death. But he feared the multitude. He feared the crowd. Because they thought, and they counted, and thought confirmed that John was a prophet. And of course, they were quite right about this. The Lord himself confirmed that John was a prophet in Matthew 11 and verse 9. When he said of John, "But what did you go out to see, a prophet? Yes, I say to you, and more than a prophet." So the Lord confirmed that John was a prophet, and in fact, even more. And so Herod feared to put him to death because of the crowd's opinion of him. Verse 6, "But when Herod's birthday was celebrated, the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod." So Herodias' daughter was, of course, her daughter by her legitimate husband, Herod Philip I. Now history tells us, though the Bible doesn't, history tells us that this girl's name was Salome. However, some people have gotten all excited about this fact and have decided, oh, Salome? Well, the Bible mentions a Salome as being a believer in Mark 15, verse 40, and Mark 16 and verse 1 as being one of the Lord's followers. So maybe this Salome actually believed in Christ and became one of his followers and was a disciple, and the story had a happy ending. She was sorry she'd done this. Well, we don't deny that that would make an interesting story. The problem is that there's no historical evidence or reason to think that she became a believer or became one of the Lord's followers. And in spite of the fact that we like interesting stories, it appears that this one is just made up. Historically, it seems that this Salome went into exile with her mother and her lover, Herod Antipas. And history says that her death took place while they were crossing an icy river, and she broke through the ice into the icy water and drowned. So that was the end of this Salome. Now, it said that she danced before them, and danced, it's usually, I think, when people give this story, assumed that this was erotic dancing. Belly dancing or some other form of erotic dancing that she was doing before them. However, I would point out that danced is used elsewhere for children at play. In Matthew 11, 17, remember when the children complained, "We played the flute for you and you did not dance." Well, of course the children weren't expecting their playmates to do an erotic dance. So this dancing may or may not have been erotic. And it largely depends on just how old she was at this point. Of course, was she a young child, not yet hit puberty, say 10 or 11 or 12? A girl generally wouldn't hit puberty by 12 at the time. Some have in our day. But not at that time. Or was she older? Was she maybe 15 or 16? In which case, certainly, likely it was erotic dancing. Well, I think the story would be very different one way or the other. If she was young, if she was just a child, it may simply be that she was playing, putting on a little show for Herod and his guests, and she was so clever and so funny, and she was so popular with his guests, and Herod, under the influence of drink, sees how popular she is and wants to be magnanimous and makes his outrageous oath. If she was older, however, a blooming young woman, well, that wouldn't be too unusual. The fact is that in a lot of, we might say, illicit relationships, like Herod's, in our day, live-in situations, where a woman with children brings a man to live with her in her home, well, a man is in the home for sex, basically, not because he's made any commitment to the woman or the family. He's just there for sex, and if sex is good with a mother, then why not with a daughter? And the fact is that most child abuse cases are in a case like that, a mother's live-in boyfriend or her second husband or something. And it's much more rare with the child's actual father. Now, of course, it does sometimes happen to the actual father, but it's rare. It's much more often a stepfather or a live-in situation like this. So that Herod could have the hots for his wife's daughter, that wouldn't be too unusual, especially if he'd been drinking at his birthday party. But like I say, it all depends on her age. And so I'm not just going along with that 100%, since we don't know her age. If she was younger, that might not have been what it was about at all. But whatever the case, she was so popular with Herod and his guests that he thought that he would just show what a big man he was. Verse 7, therefore he promised with an oath to give her whatever she might ask. So like I say, him wanting to prove he's such a big man, he makes this promise. And that's the word in Greek, homologeo, which means to say the same thing. In this case, in the sense of saying right now he'll do whatever she wants, even before knowing what she wants, and when he finds out later what she wants, he'll still say the same thing and do it. And this was not too unusual for kings to do this, and the usual thing was for them to say that I'll give you whatever you want, up to half the kingdom. Which basically was the same thing as saying, up to making you my prime minister. But of course, I'm not going to put you in my place and make you the ruler, but I'll make you the second ruler, all the way up till that. Now, Herod doesn't seem to have specifically said this, and maybe he figured a girl like this wouldn't want to be prime minister. But he offers her whatever she wants. Verse 8, so she, having been prompted by her mother, said, give me John the Baptist's head here on a platter. So notice that this was not her desire. This wasn't what she wanted. But she was incited, instigated, or persuaded by her mother. Now it seems very doubtful to me what some people have speculated, that this was actually a carefully laid trap ahead of time. That Herodias had sent her daughter in to, and this idea usually goes along with her being older and it being erotic dance, sent her daughter in, noting the kind of man Herod was, and figuring he'd do something like this, and then she could use it to put John the Baptist to death. Well, I find this doubtful. First of all, like I said, I'm not convinced it was erotic dancing because I don't know her age. But even if it was, how in the world could her mother know that Herod would make such an outrageous oath just because she'd done this dance? And would she really want to send her daughter to be her rival for her man's affections? Now, Mark 6:24 tells us that after he made this promise to Herodias' daughter, she had to actually leave to find and ask her mother what she should ask for, which seems to me something that would point to her being younger, not to her being old enough that she could be attracting a man and maybe thinking about having ambitions of her own. It sounds like a younger child that had run and asked her mother. So I think there's no evidence here that she was a co-conspirator in a plot. Just a child who was caught up as a stooge in the vengeance of her hateful mother. And no doubt Herodias immediately saw in this, when her daughter brought this to her, a chance to get her way. And she latched onto it. So, prompted by her mother, she said this, give me John the Baptist's head here on a platter. And the Greek word means a flat thing like a board, probably a platter. I think of almost like, you know, a lunch tray. And here comes John the Baptist's head on it. A grisly dinner indeed for the hateful vengeance of this wicked Herodias. Verse 9, and the king was sorry. Nevertheless, because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he commanded it to be given to her. So Herod was sorry. And although, remember, originally when he was angry at John for what he said, he wanted to put him to death. He had feared the multitude, decided the best policy was not to. And no doubt his anger had cooled off some here. And thinking about his position, he thought it would be bad. Rulers are always greatly outnumbered by their people. If the people ever got mad enough, they would greatly outnumber them, and that would be it for the ruler. So rulers have to always be worried about this sort of thing. But, sorry or not, it seems that he would rather save his face than save John the Baptist. So, because of the oaths and because of all those who sat with him would heard him say them, he gives the command to give her John's head. Verse 10, so he sent and had John beheaded in prison. And this was certainly a wicked mission that he sent to be fulfilled. Now, the Greek word here is pempo, which means just a simple sending and not an official sending. And indeed, Herod had no official legal reason to put John to death. So this was just in his word as king and not on any official decree of his. Verse 11, and his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. So they carried this out. And this righteous man, this great servant of the Lord, John the Baptist, whom the Lord said was the greatest of all the prophets, the Old Testament prophets, was put to death because of the petty vengeance of this immoral woman. What a sad end. Well, then they brought the head on the platter to the girl. And this word for girl in Greek is used elsewhere for the 12-year-old girl he raised from her death-like illness. As we talked about earlier in Matthew, although the word is actually used in Mark 5 and verse 42. So Salome may have been of a similar age, 12, or like I said, even younger. And her age really depends on what kind of dancing it was. But her mother was the real instigator of the bloody deed. And yet she was the one who got the prize. And yet she brought this prize she had won to her mother. Verse 12, then his disciples came and took away the body and buried it and went and told Jesus. So John's disciples found out about this, and they went and buried his body. And who knows what happened to his head. Maybe Herodias kept it around as a trophy until it started stinking and then had it buried or thrown into a trash heap or something. Who knows? But his body, anyway, was buried honorably. And then his disciples went and told Jesus. And I can't help but think that this is a good example, that going and telling Jesus is always a good thing to do in our troubles, or when we have to bury a loved one. And as Peter once said, to whom else would we go? And so they did right to go to their Lord here. Now I wonder, now that John was gone, did these disciples of John, when they went to Jesus, did they become his disciples and follow him instead? Maybe. Maybe some of them did, maybe some of them didn't. We aren't really told. But at least it was good they went to Jesus. So the sad end of John the Baptizer was brought about by the jealousy of an immoral woman and the outrageous oath of a proud and probably drunk king. This faithful man of God came to this sad end. Yet in standing for the Lord and his truth, he actually had the victory. Do we stand for truth in spite of the hateful disagreement of the godless world? Will we be faithful to our message come what may? Let us learn this lesson from the unwavering John the Baptizer.
The outrageous promise of Herod results in John the Baptizer going down in history as a hero of the faith. John is a wonderful example of standing firm in one's conviction concerning Jesus Christ. Have we also given this kind of supremacy to Christ in our lives? Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on the outrages of Herod. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series on the book of Matthew with Feeding the Multitude. Thank you for joining us today. Our hope is that the more you are studying God's Word, the more you know and love God. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. We also send out a weekly email newsletter in which Nathan does the same thing he does on this program, going verse by verse through the Bible and then discussing what it means. Email Nathan at nathan@knowinggodintheword.org and ask to be placed on this mailing list. You can also write to us with Bible questions or comments. For more Bible study literature by Nathan and other Bible teachers, including Seed and Bread Bible studies, please visit the Word of Truth Ministry at seedandbread.org or write to the Word of Truth Ministry, P.O. Box 1609, Canyon Country, California, 91386. Although your donations are always appreciated, you will not be solicited for funds in any way when you write, so feel free to contact us. This program has been brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry. I've been your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. So long. We look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.